to Dr. Tiffany Willoughby Herard. We know that we're demanding that they drop the charges against Dr. Tiffany Willoughby Herard and all of those who've been arrested in the midst of righteous protests. Please follow BLM Grassroots for more tangible calls to action, including how we show up for them as they fight these criminal charges and what we must do to demand a free Palestine. We hope to see you in these streets at 12 o'clock on Wednesday for End Police Association's 1313 West 8th Street. And also, we'll be having a protest for the family of Brandon Boyd on Tuesday. Just got that information in. It's Black Xmas. Withdraw your dollars from white supremacist corporations and build Black, buy Black, bank Black. Until next week, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Tyler Boudreaux. Thank you, KPFK. Peace out, y'all.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are in a very bad place. Earlier today, we called for developing countries not to accept a bad deal, to say no deal is better than a bad deal. What we have right now is a very, very bad deal.
The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan has ended. Climate justice activists and developing nations slammed the final finance deal, which they say benefits wealthy, polluting nations. We'll get an update from ActionAid's Brandon Wu and War on Wants' Asad Rehman, who both attended COP29. And we'll speak with someone who didn't, who was denied a visa. Armenian Arshak Makijan led global calls to boycott the summit.
Politicians from all around the world, human rights organizations, environmental NGOs, they are greenwashing genocide at COP29 in Baku. A genocide that was committed against indigenous Armenians in Artsakh just a year ago.
Then Trump nominates Project 2025 architect Russell Vogt to head the Office of Management and Budget. We'll look at ProPublica's investigation into Vogt's plans to fire thousands of civil servants and support deploying the military domestically, based on recordings they obtained of his private speeches at the Center for Renewing America.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are so, they are increasingly viewed as the villains.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan has ended, with wealthy, polluting nations pledging to pay a total of $300 billion a year to help developing nations cope with the climate crisis they themselves did not create. But the agreement was widely denounced by nations in the global south and by climate justice activists. India's chief negotiator, Chandni Raina, described the deal as nothing more than an optical illusion.
We are disappointed with the outcome, which clearly brings out the unwillingness of the developed country parties to fulfill their responsibilities. As we struggle to deal with climate change, the outcome proposed in the paper will further affect our ability to adapt to climate change, greatly impact our NDC ambitions and its implementation, and create further challenges to our resilience, and above all, will severely impact growth.
We'll have more on the UN climate summit after headlines. In Gaza, Israel's repeatedly attacked the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia as Israel's siege on northern Gaza continues. One drone strike injured the hospital's director, Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, who's repeatedly risked his life to keep the hospital open. Last month, his 8-year-old son Ibrahim died in an Israeli attack. On Saturday, Dr. Safia spoke from a hospital gurney in intensive care after the attack.
They are targeting everyone. But by God, this will not stop us from completing our humanitarian role, and we will continue to provide this service at any cost to us. We are still calling upon the world and will keep calling to the hope that there are those with consciences. I was injured in my place of work, and this is an honor for me to be injured in this place, since my blood is not better or more valuable than the rest of the martyrs. But this will not stop us. And we will continue to provide humanitarian service in a place known to the world. And we will provide it, God willing, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, no matter what, even if it costs our lives.
12 other healthcare workers were injured at Kamel Adwan Hospital in another Israeli attack on Friday. Israel also bombed a building in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, where several families were staying. At least 9 people died, including children.
The world is unfair. We are being killed and they are not doing anything. There is no food, water, and there is a besiege. And they kill us and everyone is watching. We only have God. May their souls rest in peace. Ahmed, Musa, and all his friends. They were friends together when they were killed.
Heavy rains and flooding is leading to more misery in Gaza. A civil defense spokesperson said Sunday, quote, rainfall has caused severe damage to tents housing thousands of displaced people, with water flowing inside the tents and damaging luggage and mattresses, unquote. Meanwhile, Hamas has announced an Israeli airstrike killed a female Israeli hostage in northern Gaza and injured another. The Israeli military did not confirm or refute the claim. Israel is also continuing to bombard Lebanon. On Saturday, an Israeli airstrike in central Beirut killed at least 29 people and injured 67 others. Survivors said no warning was issued before the attack.
What can I tell you? We escaped from Beirut's southern suburbs, Dahia, and we said we'd take shelter in Beirut because it's safe. What happened in Dahia has happened to Beirut. At least in Dahia, there's warnings and people leave. In Beirut, it happens without warning. Crime after crime, children killed. It's enough what happened in Gaza and what's happening here and what happened in Dahia.
Hezbollah responded by firing about 250 projectiles into Israel. This all comes as new reports are circulating. The Israeli government has agreed in principle to a ceasefire in Lebanon. In other news from Lebanon, Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing an apparent war crime by killing 3 journalists and injuring 4 others last month. Human Rights Watch found Israel killed the Lebanese journalists using an airdrop bomb equipped with a U.S.-produced Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kit and what the group said was, quote, most likely a deliberate attack, unquote. The Israeli Knesset unanimously voted to sanction the Haaretz newspaper, saying the paper's editorials, quote, have hurt the legitimacy of the state of Israel and its right to self-defense, unquote. Under the move, the government will stop advertising in the paper and cut off communications with it. Haaretz responded by saying the decision is, quote, another step in Netanyahu's journey to dismantle Israeli democracy, unquote. In other news related to Israel, authorities in the United Arab Emirates have arrested 3 people after the body of an Israeli rabbi, Zvi Kogan, was discovered Sunday, 3 days after he went missing. President-elect Donald Trump has picked Project 2025 co-author Russell Vogt to lead the White House Office of Management and Budget again. Vogt helped draft the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint to radically reshape federal agencies. During the campaign, Trump distanced himself from Project 2025, but he's now tapping its authors for key posts. Over the weekend, Trump announced a number of other cabinet and high-level positions, including the billionaire hedge fund manager Scott Bessent to be Treasury Secretary. Bessent once worked for George Soros, but has since embraced Trump's use of tariffs and push for deregulation. For Labor Secretary, Trump tapped Congressmember Lori Chavez de Remer, one of the few Republican lawmakers to support the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to unionize. Trump has also named controversial far-right pundit Sebastian Gorka to become senior National Security Council director for counterterrorism and deputy assistant to the president. It's a top post that doesn't require Senate confirmation. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary while he served as a Hungarian politician. During an interview earlier this month on the Russian broadcaster RT, Gorka denied Palestine exists.
Why can't you talk about genocide in Gaza? And is that the same with all of the Trump?
Because there isn't any genocide in Gaza. A, there is no such thing as Palestine. Do you know what the etymology of the word Palestinian is? It was a name invented by the Roman Empire.
Yeah, the problem is, as an impartial interlocutor, you know that is not shared by the rest of the world. The rest of the world disagrees with you, so you're going to be as ice. You're going to be a game.
I'm glad you talk for the rest of the world.
Trump has picked former Florida Congressmember Dr. Dave Wilden to be the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Wilden is a vaccine skeptic who supported the debunked theory linking vaccines to autism. For Surgeon General, Trump tapped Fox News contributor Dr. Jeanette Nishawat, who serves as one of the medical directors at CityMD, a chain of urgent care centers in New York. Trump picked another frequent Fox News commentator, Dr. Martin McCary, to head the Food and Drug Administration during the COVID pandemic. McCary was a vocal critic of vaccine mandates. In a surprise pick, Trump has also nominated Brooke Rollins to be agriculture secretary. She served in the first Trump administration and co-founded the America First Policy Institute. Trump's also named former NFL player and White House official Scott Turner to head HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. This all comes as ethics experts are raising alarms over Trump's refusal to reveal who's funding his transition operations. Trump has yet to sign an ethics agreement to begin the formal transition process, which has prevented the FBI from doing background checks on any of his nominees. In other Trump news, New York Judge Juan Merchan has indefinitely postponed sentencing the president-elect over his criminal hush money conviction. In May, a Manhattan jury found Trump guilty on all 34 felony charges of attempting to influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment. In Uruguay, the center-left opposition candidate Yamandú Orsi won a runoff presidential election Sunday, defeating Álvaro Delgado of the ruling center-right Partido Nacional. Orsi is a former mayor, history teacher with the Frente Amplio, or Broad Front Party. He spoke from Montevideo after his victory.
In Uruguay,
I am going to be the president who builds a more integrated society, a more integrated country, where, in addition, despite the differences, no one can ever be left behind from an economic, social, and also political point of view.
In news from Pakistan, authorities in Islamabad are fortifying the city as tens of thousands of protesters head toward the capital to demand freedom for ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan. Schools in Islamabad are closed. Social media apps are partially suspended. Heavily armed police have set up containers throughout the city. More than 4,000 Khan supporters have recently been arrested. Khan has been in prison since August 2023 on what are widely viewed as politically motivated charges. In the Philippines, Vice President Sara Duterte threatened to have Filipino President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., his wife, and the Filipino House Speaker assassinated if she is killed amidst an escalating public falling out between the country's rulers. Sara Duterte made these shocking comments during an official briefing that was live streamed on Facebook in response to a viewer comment about her own safety.
I have talked to a person. I said, if I get killed, go kill Ferdinand Marcos Jr., First Lady Lisa Araneta, and Speaker Martin Romualdez. No joke, no joke. I said, do not stop until you kill them. And then he said yes.
President Marcos Jr.'s security has been increased as he vowed to take action following the threat. Sara Duterte is the daughter of President Marcos Jr.'s predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte, who last month admitted he led a death squad while he was the mayor of Davao, and who's being investigated by the International Criminal Court over his so-called war on drugs, which killed thousands of people. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is the son of the dictator Ferdinand Marcos, who ruled the Philippines from 1965 until 1986, when he was overthrown in a popular uprising. In South Korea, negotiations have begun to create a global treaty to dramatically reduce plastic pollution. On Saturday, about 1,500 people marched in Busan, carrying banners reading, "Cut plastic production and drastic plastic reduction now." And in Australia, police arrested some 170 people as activists and kayaks formed a blockade at sea to shut down maritime traffic to the port of Newcastle, one of the world's largest coal ports. Thousands took part in the climate action in the state of New South Wales. This is Peter Schofield, a doctor and activist with the group Rising Tide Australia.
We're here in Newcastle. We're a singularity, really. It's in a unique place, it being the largest coal port in the world, exporting vast amounts of coal. If we can make a difference here, and if we can demonstrate our commitment as a community and as a government to influencing things such that, you know, we minimise that, that can have worldwide implications. And so, you know, what we do here is very, very important.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, has ended, with wealthy, polluting nations pledging to pay a total of $300 billion a year to help developing nations cope with the climate crisis until 2035. Climate justice activists in Global South nations slammed the final finance deal. In a minute, we'll speak with Warren Wants Asad Rehman in London, just back from COP29 in Baku. But first, as Democracy Now! Broadcast from COP29 last week, I spoke Friday to Brandon Wu, the director of policy campaigns at ActionAid USA. I asked about his thoughts on the deal. At the time, it stood at $215 billion a year at that point, and it caused the talks to stall.
We are in a very bad place. Earlier today, we called for developing countries not to accept a bad deal, to say no deal is better than a bad deal. What we have right now is a very, very bad deal. Remember, our baseline, what we have right now, which is not working, it's not enough, is $100 billion a year. That pledge was made in 2009. So we're barely getting any increase at all. And what's actually worse is that it could include private investment, market rate loans. It's not an actual transfer of resources from rich to poor countries, which is what we need to solve this crisis.
Explain what private is. What does that mean?
So that is a very good question. You know, in theory, it means, oh, this country might have spent a little bit of money to enable private investment to flow into a country. And then they'll say, for every dollar of money we put in, we leverage $7 of private investment. Who is defining those leverage ratios? Like, there's very little evidence base for how we actually count this reliably. And private investment only flows to certain places where investors think they can make a profit, right? So many of the communities that are suffering worse from this crisis are not a place where anybody is going to make a profit, or at least not in this sense. And so they're not going to see any of that money. What we need and what developing countries have asked for is a core of money that is public grant-based money, and that is not here. We're not seeing any of that.
So you're from the United States, the most powerful country on Earth, the historically largest greenhouse gas emitter. Yeah. What role has the U.S. played here?
The U.S. at every turn has undermined the climate regime from the beginning. So what we're seeing now is actually the end of a 10-year strategy to exit from our obligations to provide climate finance. The Paris Agreement itself was the end of the U.S. strategy to exit from having any obligations to reduce our own emissions. Remember, we moved from the Kyoto Protocol, which had binding obligations, to the Paris Agreement, which was 100% voluntary. It was the U.S. that was behind that. And now what we're seeing is in the UN Convention on Climate Change, there is a binding obligation for developed countries to provide finance. And again, that could mean mobilizing private investment. It doesn't actually mean moving public money from the global north to the global south. And so it's an exit. It's a great escape is what we're calling it, a great escape from their obligations to the rest of the world.
What would the U.S. taking the lead on true climate crisis reform look like?
So it would mean cutting our emissions at home. So implementing something that looks like a Green New Deal, for example, right? We can quibble about the exact policies and what that would look like, but a massive transformation, a just transition of our own economy towards a more sustainable economy. And we know that's not enough because the climate crisis is global. And so it also means providing massive amounts of climate finance to enable action in other parts of the world where we know it has to happen. We know all the poorest countries in the world have to transition their economies, and we also know they don't have the resources for it. And so a country like the United States, where we've built our economy on pollution, right? We've built our economy on greenhouse gas emissions. We owe climate finance or a climate debt to the rest of the world.
So we're talking about the Biden administration right now. That's who's represented. That's who is the climate envoy, John Podesta, and his delegation. What about President Trump, a next president, past president, who pulled us out of the Paris Agreement and promises to do it again? What will that look like?
So that's our fight at home, right? That's our fight at home. And I think the thing that President Trump does is his extremism mobilizes people, right? We got a Green New Deal, a vision for a Green New Deal, because people realized we're in a really bad place here under the Trump administration. We need a radical vision for a better world, and we're going to create that vision and we're going to fight for it. And so it's really unfortunate that we have to go back to that place, but that's where we are. And, you know, I hate to say it's an opportunity because I know, you know, the Trump administration is going to cause untold damage at home and abroad. But at the same time, that is an opportunity for us to develop the radical vision that we need, because right now we're just rearranging the deck chairs.
That was Brandon Wu, Director of Policy and Campaigns at ActionAid USA, speaking Friday at the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. As talks at COP29 went into overtime on Saturday, frustrated representatives from poorer global South countries and small island nations walked out of a negotiating room, but said they remained committed to finding a fair deal. Ultimately, a $1.3 trillion climate finance deal was announced Sunday morning, $300 billion a year for 10 years. It was $50 billion more than when I talked to Brandon Wu on Friday. For more on the latest developments, we're joined by Asad Rehman, Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. It seemed like he was everywhere at these UN climate talks, but I guess not in the negotiating rooms. Asad, you're back in London. If you can start off by just unpacking what this amount of money means.
Well, first of all, let's just clarify, it's not $300 billion. Dollars a year. It's $300 billion by 2035. And so there's no clarity about how much money will be provided each and every year. I mean, it could be $100 billion every year and $300 billion in 2035. Secondly, we don't know how much of that is going to be in grant-based finance and how much is in either debt-creating loans or other financial instruments. And just to also put it into perspective, $300 billion, if you take into inflation, count inflation, by 2035, it will be worth about $175 billion. Currently, Africa, the continent of Africa, pays in unjust debt repayments about $170 billion. So not only is it a drop in the ocean compared to what is needed, but it is a figure that masks the lack of responsibility by developed countries to put up the finance, the necessary critical finance that is needed for developing countries to be able to deal with the crisis that they haven't caused.
Pick up on that last point, that they haven't caused, because so many these days, especially in the most polluting countries, look at the United States, where we have President Trump coming up again, say, why should we give charities to these poor countries? But explain why this is not charity, but debt.
So, if you take the carbon budgets, the amount of pollution you can put into the atmosphere before temperatures begin to rise, that is calculated. There's this much carbon budget for preventing, for example, a breach of the critical guardrail of 1.5 degrees, after which we begin to start to spiral out of control. At 2 degrees, it becomes very, very difficult for anybody to be able to adapt. At 3 degrees, really the notion of society as we know it, as it's currently constructed, would be very hard to realise or recognise that that could function in the same way. We're currently heading towards that 3-degree target. We're going to, often we say that 1.5 degrees is on life support. 4/5 of the carbon budget for 1.5 has already been used. And that's been used over the last 150, 200 years, overwhelmingly by the rich developed countries in the global north, way more than they are entitled to. So most of the global north countries have consumed 3 times to 5 times more than it would be equitable. So if you shared the carbon budget equally amongst all countries, the global north has overconsumed what they've done. Therefore, they owe a debt to the global south. First, for overconsumption of that carbon budget, which is now denied to developing countries, so they're not able to use it to develop, but also the consequence of overconsuming. And of course, we see that on a daily basis with killer floods, droughts, famine, storms, devastating so many people's lives and livelihoods. That is quantified as a climate debt.
What happens now, Asad Rehman? How does this money, how is it transferred, however low it is?
Well, I mean, again, now there will be lots of ongoing fights and struggle about what that $300 billion actually constitutes. When we began COP29 in Baku, the presidency gaveled through another important motion, which was the creation of a global carbon market. Now, a global carbon market basically says, you know, you can buy permits to pollute. So rich countries don't have to cut their own emissions, but they could buy a permit which would reduce emissions in another place and they would, you know, carry on as business as usual. Now, clearly, there's no carbon budget for those permits to be able to work. But often rich developed countries say, well, that is climate finance. That is the flow of money. Now, in 20 years of different carbon markets operating, none of that money has actually flowed in the figures and in the way that is needed to developing countries. So now we're really going to get into the meat of it. What is this $300 billion? How much will be public finance? How much will be debt-creating loans? How much is it going to be actually asking developing countries to contribute to themselves, for themselves? And of course, many of the developing countries are already being overwhelmed, not just by the climate crisis, but about ongoing issues of inequality and being trapped into unjust tax and trade and debt burdens.
Finally, Asad Rehman, next year, COP30 will be in Brazil, the first time next to the rainforest. The significance of this, what it means, and do you think, as all of the climate justice groups were saying on Friday, no deal is better than a bad deal?
Yes, the reason why we were saying no deal is better than a bad deal was because, you know, we wanted, if rather than a deal which was going to be deadly for people and planet, which was going to be insufficient, inadequate, and of course, in the words of many developing countries, was an insult and a joke, it would be better to delay that to Brazil so that we could actually continue to negotiate and work. As you know, for 2 weeks, rich developed countries didn't put a figure on the table until the final day. That meant there was very, very little opportunity to be able to interrogate that figure or to find out more detail. Now, with Brazil coming up, there is an opportunity, not only because of the presidency, which has said that it's committed to tackling climate, but that also we as civil society, you know, have social movements in Brazil. And of course, we're able to exert pressure both on the outside and on the inside. And there are some fundamental big debates going to take place over this year, which will shape that. What happens with the UN tax convention? Will rich countries continue to block that, which is the opportunity to tax corporations fairly in the places they do business and do damage? Will there be a global wealth tax so that the richest 1%, who are responsible for about 16% of global emissions and seize most of the world's wealth, actually pay fairly? Those are places where new money can be made available. Will we shift away from the subsidies and handouts to fossil fuel and industrial agribusiness? That will liberate money. But there's also a very big debate going to take place in Brazil, which will be around the just transition. That's a vision of what comes next in the world. Will it be fair? Will we be able to guarantee people's lives and livelihoods through things like public services, making food and energy available to everybody? Will we reform our global financial architecture? All of that will be on the table in Brazil. And we hope that that is an opportunity, through building our power at both national and global level, that we can move the dial towards an outcome which actually is in the interests of people.
Baku to the future. Assad Raymond, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition, today speaking to us from London, last week from Baku. The UN Climate Summit has ended, but of course, we will continue to cover all of these climate issues. Next up, we'll speak with someone who, unlike Assad, was denied a visa, could not attend the UN climate talks in Baku. Armenian Arshak Makijan led global calls to boycott the talks. Stay with us.
My people of the world, come let us stand in solidarity. As the world is in crisis, from the loss and the damage the whole world is going through. Wealthy nations are failing to act, they cannot fulfill a promise. As the years go by, people and they die, it's a call for one action. Our world is crushing, our world is dying. Tell me who is gonna save us from the loss and the damage. Our world is crushing, our people are dying. Tell me who is gonna save us from the loss and the damage. Tell me who is gonna save our world.
Us Who by Climate Action Network International, written for the climate justice activists as they danced to the song at the UN Climate Summit, COP29. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Politicians from all around the world, human rights organizations, environmental NGOs, they're greenwashing genocide at COP29 in Baku. Those are the words of our next guest, Arshak Makijan, who led global calls to boycott this year's UN climate talks hosted in Baku as Azerbaijan continues to detain Armenian political prisoners. And as a new report released on the first day of COP29 by an international fact-finding mission found Azerbaijan committed ethnic cleansing against the Armenian people while it carried out massacres in Nagorno-Karabakh in 2023. The war led to the forced expulsion of some 100,000 Armenians from the region last year. The report, Why Are There No Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, draws on more than 300 interviews with Karabakh Armenians who survived the attacks and describe human rights violations, including the torture and mass killing of Armenians by Azerbaijani forces with impunity. The report also found ongoing violations in Nagorno-Karabakh as Azerbaijan destroys Armenian cultural monuments, churches, cemeteries, and residential neighborhoods. Prominent Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg was among those who did not attend COP29 in protest. Instead, she spent time in Yerevan, Armenia.
Azerbaijan, as previous people here on stage have said, is an extremely repressive state, a petrol state that is planning to expand fossil fuel production and is responsible for ethnic cleansing. It is absolutely nauseating, to say the least, the hypocrisy, the extreme hypocrisy that this climate conference, COP29, is being held in that country right now. The continuous extreme hardships that many Armenians are facing because of the Azerbaijani military aggression, the torture, forcefully displacement, prisoners of war, hostages, and the ethnic cleansing and the extreme physical and psychological violence that people have experienced can, in absolutely no way be justified.
So that was Greta Thunberg, not at the COP29, but in Yerevan, Armenia. Armenia did not participate in the COP29 climate summit in Baku due to Azerbaijan's refusal to free at least 23 Armenian political prisoners detained there. Meanwhile, other Armenian activists who planned to attend the talks, including our next guest, were denied visas to Azerbaijan. We go now to Berlin, Germany, where we're joined by Arshak Makijan, exiled Russian, Armenian, anti-war human rights and climate activist. His recent citizenship was revoked last year. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Arshak. So explain what happened. Interestingly, our studio at UN Climate Summit was right next to the Karabakh room. Talk about Armenia in relation to Azerbaijan and why you weren't there.
It's important to say that my grandparents, they have been deported from Nakhichevan Republic, and the same as all other Armenians, they have been deported from them. And the ethnic cleansing or genocides started not yesterday or not in 2023. Azerbaijani colonial policies, they started long ago. And what happened in Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh was continuation of the Armenian genocide. And like, I do not want to talk about me, that they denied me of visa, though my grandparents are from Nakhichevan. I want to talk about what happened to Armenians, what they survived, the blockade and then total ethnic cleansing. It was horrible. And the worst thing was that we were alone. Like, we were protesting in Berlin and all around the world, and all the people, all civil societies all around the world, they ignored the blockade and then the total ethnic cleansing. And the same happened at COP29, where Azerbaijan was greenwashing the genocide against Armenians. No one spoke up about it, not Greenpeace or not Human Rights Watch or not Amnesty International. I was also reading the reports on social media. I was reading the report of Human Rights Watch, 74 pages about human rights violations in Azerbaijan. Not a single word about Armenians. Then Amnesty report, 8 pages. Not a single word about Armenians. Greenpeace, they speak up against greenwashing or for indigenous rights. And then they totally ignore this issue while they participate at COP29. I was disappointed because I worked with Greenpeace a lot in Russia, also with Greenpeace International. I was disappointed in many things. I don't understand why Azerbaijan was allowed to greenwash the genocide. They declared that Nagorno-Karabakh or Nakhichevan now are the green zone. They're going to build a few sort of plants, and they continuously destroyed the houses of my friends. They are looting their houses. They were looting their houses during the COP29, and everyone, they just ignored it during the conference. I'm totally disappointed in like all these organizations. I believe they are complicit in the genocide and greenwashing genocide.
Can you talk about what the International Court of Justice and if the International Criminal Court have weighed in at this point? The ICJ ruling Armenia and Azerbaijan discrimination cases can proceed forward as they kind of sue each other?
Basically, ICJ had a decision that Azerbaijan had to guarantee the safe return of Armenians. But in contrary, they continue to destroy our Armenians' homes. They are looting their houses. And the problem is also that Azerbaijan is blackmailing Armenian government, and they demand Armenia, Eastern Armenia, to stop these cases because they do not want them, and they blackmail Armenia by starting another war. So the thing is that Eastern Armenia is now in danger also, and the problem is that I'm really afraid that the Armenian government will stop these cases at some point to have a peace with Azerbaijan, and I believe that peace is impossible with Azerbaijan. International civil society should pressure Azerbaijani government. We should have embargo the same way as we have embargo on Russian fossil fuels. We should have an embargo on Azerbaijani fossil fuels. We should sanction all Azerbaijani politicians, and it's quite possible to put pressure on them because Azerbaijani ruling family, they have a lot of property in the UK. Like, they have a lot of castles, and I also believe that the UK government is complicit because they BP, British Petroleum corporation is having a lot of projects in, also in Nagorno-Karabakh, where they ethnically cleansed Armenians. So I think it's really important to do something now to stop the Armenian genocide. What was happening was continuation of Armenian genocide, and we continue to be threatened. Every person who speaks up about it, they are being threatened by the Azerbaijan and also Turkey, because the Azerbaijan, they work with Turkey, and like the ethnic cleansing or the genocide happened with complicity of Russia. Russian peacekeepers, they did nothing to stop it. And I think it's really important now for everyone to support Armenia and also to create platforms for Armenians from Artsakh, because Armenian government, they say that we don't represent Armenians from Artsakh. Because they are blackmailed by Azerbaijan. Also, they say that they don't represent Armenians from Western Armenia, and majority of Armenians in the diaspora, they are from the Western Armenia, which is now like Eastern Turkey or occupied. So I think it's important right now to think why the international law doesn't apply to our region. Because what happened with Armenians at the beginning of 20th century, till today, we cannot return to Western Armenia. I cannot visit Nakhichevan. What about, like, if, like, Nakhichevan is Azerbaijan, what about our indigenous rights? Also the same with Artsakh. So I think it's really important for us to demand from UN real action. They did nothing during the blockade. We were demanding them to send some food, some medication to do Artsakh. They did nothing. And now, like, they continue to do nothing. Though, like, Armenians, they cannot return to their homes. And this is unacceptable. I have no trust in international law. I have no trust in institutions that we have built, and also civil society. And I think we should do something about it, because international law should apply to everyone.
You have your last few years been incredibly difficult, Arshak. We spoke to, I think, in Russia. And then when you went into exile, this is after Russia invaded Ukraine. We're now speaking to you in Berlin. If you can talk about, do you have Armenian citizenship?
Yeah, I was stateless for 1 year, and I applied for Armenian citizenship, and I got it. But so if Azerbaijan starts a war against Armenia, I will go out to fight against them, because, yeah,
finally,
that's my country.
You make comparisons between what's happening with Armenia in relation to Azerbaijan to what's happening in Gaza. Your final thoughts?
I think, like, what is happening right now in Gaza, the genocide was in some ways inspired by what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh. The world ignored 1 year of blockade of Nagorno-Karabakh, and then, Aliyev had a successful ethnic cleansing. And now, like, he was hosting the COP29, he a lot of world leaders, they were shaking his hands and pretending that he's not a war criminal. And so, like, I think these kind of atrocities, they inspire each other. Like, the same way Armenian genocide inspired Hitler to commit the Holocaust, and there was this quote of Hitler who remembers Armenians. So I think this is not just about Armenians, and what was happening, the greenwashing of genocide at COP29, it's not about Armenians. It is about everyone. Like, the world failed us for the second time. And if we want to have a solution for everyone, and if we want to have trust in international law, NGOs, or whatever, we should work together and to fight against these dictators together. And instead, like, all these organizations, all these politicians, they are having new compromises. Like, Europe had the embargo on Russian gas, and now, like, Russia Azerbaijan is reselling Russian gas with that. And this is unacceptable. I think we should work together and to build some kind of new systems that will not fail us.
Arshak Makijan, we want to thank you for being with us, exiled Russian Armenian anti-war human rights and climate activist. His Russian citizenship was revoked in 2023. He was denied a visa to Azerbaijan to attend the UN climate talks. He's now based in Berlin, Germany. Next up, President-elect Trump has nominated the Project 2025 architect, Russell Vogt, to lead the Office of Management and Budget again. We'll look at ProPublica's investigation into Vogt's plans to fire thousands of civil servants and his support for deploying the military domestically. That's here at home and more. Stay with us.
If this world were mine, I would place at your feet all that I own. You've been so good to me. If this world were mine, I'd give you the flowers, the birds and the bees, and your love beside me. That would be all I need. If this world were mine, I'd give you anything.
If this world were mine, I would make...
If This World Were Mine, performed by Cheryl Lynn and Luther Vandross. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Donald Trump tried to distance himself during his campaign from Project 2025, the radical right-wing plan for a second term. But on Friday, he nominated a key architect of the plan, Russell Vogt, to lead the Office of Management and Budget once again. Vogt had led the office during Trump's first term for a time. The Trump loyalist wrote the chapter of Project 2025 that lays out how to redefine the executive branch by firing thousands of civil servants. He's also supported deploying the military here at home. In a minute, we'll be joined by the ProPublica reporter whose recent investigation of Vogt's headline put them in trauma inside a key MAGA leader's plans for a new Trump agenda. It's based in part on videos ProPublica and documented obtained of private speeches Vogt gave at invitation-only annual gatherings at his pro-Trump think tank, the Center for Renewing America. This is a clip from a speech earlier this year when Vogt outlines the legal rationale for invoking the Insurrection Act, a law that empowers the president to use the military for domestic law enforcement.
We are trying to build at the Center for Renewing America almost a shadow office of management and budget. We're trying to build a shadow office of legal counsel so that when a future president says, what legal authorities do I need to shut down the riots, we want to be able to shut down the riots and not have the legal community or the defense community to come in and say that's an inappropriate use of what you're trying to do.
That's Russell Vogt, Trump's nominee to head the Office of Management and Budget, key Project 2025 architect. This is an excerpt of another video ProPublica and documented obtained. It's from a speech last year by Vogt delivered during a private gathering of the Center for Renewing America, that pro-Trump think tank. Here, Vogt describes his goal of defunding federal bureaucracies under a potential Trump second administration.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down so that the EPA can't do all of the rules against our energy industry because they have no bandwidth financially to do so. We want to put them in trauma.
So that's Project 2025 architect Russell Vogt speaking in a video obtained by Molly Redden, reporter at ProPublica, who covers national politics and elections. Molly, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what you found, the most important takeaways from these videos that you've now gotten a hold of, who Vogt is?
Vogt was the director of the Office of Management and Budget at the end of Trump's first term, and he's returning to that position. What that office does is it sets spending priorities for the entire federal government. So Congress writes the check, And then the OMB directs how that money is spent, either through regulations or just pipelining the money. And there's obviously a lot of power in that. And vote, you know, what he talked about in these videos and these sort of unguarded moments is a really expansive and aggressive vision of executive power to sort of take that money and spend it the way that Trump envisions it for, you know, a stronger executive branch, less environmental regulation, really according to sort of what they laid out in Project 2025. So really not letting Congress control the spending agenda anymore, but leaving it in the hands of a very small group of people to achieve, you know, exactly what Trump laid out on the campaign trail and what Vogt and others laid out in Project 2025. So he's in a really powerful position, and he has a really targeted and aggressive vision of how to, you know, execute what Trump has been talking about.
Now, explain what the OMB does, the Office of Management and Budget, why it's such a powerful position.
It's such a powerful position because, first of all, it oversees all of the regulations that the administration puts out. So, you know, Congress can write a check for, you heard him in those videos talk about defunding the EPA and making sure regulators don't have what they need. So even if Congress appropriates money for clean water regulation, you know, scrubbing pollution from the atmosphere, Vogt and his, you know, agency can oversee how rules get technically written so that that money can dry up. That's just one example. You know, they really get into the details of how you spend money. And that's just so incredibly powerful because that's really where the rubber meets the road for any policy in any administration.
And talk more about how he would, why being in that position would matter when it comes to his support for deploying the military at home on the streets of the United States.
That has a little bit more to do with the work that Vogt did between the two Trump administrations. So he founded a think tank called the Center for Renewing America. And what that think tank did is, in between the two administrations, sort of in that interim, it played host to a number of people who had been in high up positions of the Trump administration. And they, you know, incubated and drafted a lot of ideas for what a second Trump administration could do to execute its agenda more effectively. And I think we all remember from the first Trump administration, the president cycled through a lot of appointments who came from more traditional Republican institutional backgrounds, and a lot of them stood in the way, sort of acted as a bulwark against some of the more aggressive and, you know, history-defying things that Trump wanted to do, deploying the military against protesters during the summer of 2020. George Floyd protests is a really good example of this. And so, you know, that's over in the second Trump administration, right? You can see from his appointments whether they're, you know, people who have defended his agenda really aggressively on Fox News, or people like Russ Vogt, who have been thinking for 4 years about how to build a legal framework and staff an administration that will do whatever Trump wants, that, you know, they are really focused on making sure that they have an administration that is loyal to Trump rather than, you know, focused on what existing law says you can do. So at the Center for Renewing America, one of the things that Vogt spoke about in those videos, they are preparing legal doctrines, basically, that will rationalize Trump's domestic deployment of the military. Another thing that Vogt has been a really big proponent of is, your viewers might be familiar with Schedule F, which is basically a way to reclassify government civil servants so that they're all political appointees and easier to fire if they don't comply with what the administration wants them to do.
Molly, I wanted to go back to August. when we reported on undercover video that showed Russell Vogt bragging about his ties to Trump, even as Trump was trying to distance himself from Project 2025, it shows Vogt meeting in a five-star Washington, D.C. hotel with two men who he thought were relatives of a wealthy conservative donor. He was actually talking to two undercover reporters with the Center for Climate Reporting, an independent British news outlet. They were secretly recording him. This is part of the video accompanying their investigation called Undercover in Project 2025, the secretive second phase and the radical policies set for rollout on day one.
We want to meet the man writing the game plan for Trump's second administration. Vogt believes that in his first term, Trump's agenda was frustrated by what he calls the deep state. So Vogt is planning a radical centralization of government power under the president, firing civil servants and ending the independence of agencies like the FBI and DOJ.
80% of my time is working on the plans of what's necessary to take control of these bureaucracies. And we are working doggedly on that, whether it's destroying their agency's notion of independence, they're independent from the president.
Vogt has also been preparing documents based on fringe legal theories, arguing the president has the power to use the military against protesters.
George Floyd obviously was not about race. It was about destabilizing the Trump administration.
Right.
We put out, for instance, a 50-page paper designed for lawyers to know that the president has, you know, the ability both along the border and elsewhere to maintain law and order with the military. And that's something that, it's going to be important for him to remember and his lawyers to affirm. But we've given them the case for that.
With loyalists installed in key government agencies and armed with his playbook, Vogt believes a radical Christian nationalist agenda can be realized under a second Trump presidency. For example, on abortion.
So I think the president has actually come up with a strategy that works, so long as you are giving people like me in the government the ability to block funding for Planned Parenthood, block funding for fetal tissue research. What I've told people is he had the most pro-life record ever. I've never seen him take it to stand in the way of a pro-life initiative that actually was real, yeah, politically and with momentum.
So that was a report from a British climate justice group that went and spoke to him. He thought he was talking to, that's Russell Vogt, wealthy conservative donors. They videoed him as he spoke. But if you can comment from your research on the implications of what he said, right down to blocking the federal funding for Planned Parenthood, which runs hundreds of clinics all over the country for women's health care.
I think what you can see in that video and in some of our reporting is that a lot of what Trump said on the campaign trail to distance himself from things that were really unpopular, like Project 2025 and its vision for really concentrating an extremely aggressive amount of power in the executive branch, like new restrictions on abortion, on reproductive rights, on Planned Parenthood. I think what that shows is that a lot of that, those were political movements, those were political maneuvers meant to reassure voters who, really felt uneasy with voting for Trump, given that that's what his allies talked about his plans to do. And so I think, now that Trump has unified control of Congress and the Republicans and is feeling really good about, he's described himself as having a mandate, you're probably going to see a lot of what he denied he was going to do on the campaign trail. You're probably going to see that come to pass, at least some of it. I think Vogt's appointment is a really good piece of evidence for that. Vogt, as you described it, he was a key architect of Project 2025. A lot of the folks who worked at his think tank, the Center for Renewing America, were really instrumental in putting the plan together. He wrote a really key chapter about executive power and how to transform the presidency into the most powerful it's ever been. And so, I think Project 2025 is going to be right at home in the White House.
I And where does the first act that President Trump is pushing as he becomes president again, and that is the mass deportation of immigrants and using the military to put them in camps and detention centers and then send them home. How does vote and what he's been describing facilitate that?
So what you heard him talk about was, again, helping come up with some of the legal rationalizations so that that can happen very quickly, so that they can try to do that very quickly and without a meaningful challenge. You know, he talked about in some of the videos we obtained, talked about trying to set the national conversation and make it a lot more extreme around migration. You know, he and some other folks who worked for his think tank, people might remember Ken Cuccinelli, a top DHS executive or a top DHS official from the first Trump administration. You know, they really kind of had like a private roadshow in 2022 trying to convince a lot of southern border governors to embrace this really, you know, out there at the time, legal theory that migration at the southern border really constituted an invasion. So he really set the tone for that, too.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene is now going to head a subcommittee on government efficiency, and she says they will go after states and cities, cut off their funding if they make themselves sanctuary. Molly Redden, I want to thank you for being with us. ProPublica reporter will link to your investigation. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
I am.